This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. If you're hiring, with Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started at Indeed.com/NPR podcast.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. What a week to recap here on Folkenflik Friday. Woodward versus the White House, Kavanaugh sparks contention on the Hill, and a newspaper op-ed that scrambles everything.
Simply jaw-dropping.
I read it. I don't know who wrote it.
You have to come forward and sign your name to this.
This is not a warning from a liberal Democrat.
Hiding behind anonymity.
Living in dishonesty.
This is a warning from someone Donald Trump hired to work in the White House.
Republican and Democrats alike reacting with shock and awe over the unsigned opinion piece published in America's paper of record and one of President Trump's favorite punching bags.
The failing New York Times has an anonymous editorial. Can you believe it? Anonymous, meaning gutless, a gutless editorial.
Fireworks on Capitol Hill, even before Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh had a chance to speak. Parliamentary politicking between Senators Kamala Harris and Chuck Grassley.
We have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend
this
a very warm welcome
we have not
to
been
Judge
given
Kavanaugh
an opportunity to have a meaningful
his wife,
hearing
Ashley.
On the nominee.
This hour on Point. Our weekly news roundtable with Karen Tumulty, Perry Bacon Jr., and Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Is Anonymous a turncoat, a patriot, or just another Washington infighter? Do you fear Bob Woodward's newest bestseller? Pre-ordered it. Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Washington is Karen Tumulty. She's a Washington Post columnist who covers national politics. Karen Tumulty, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, David. Great to be here with you and Jack and Perry, my former colleague at two news organizations.
You can't shake the man. He's actually coming to us from the studios of the friendly confines of WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky, as now a senior political writer for 538. Perry Bacon Jr., welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, David.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Karen, and Perry.
Karen, why don't you start us off? What a week. Let's talk about first that New York Times op-ed, the opinion piece written by an unnamed senior White House official. Does it matter that we don't know who he is? And does it matter what he or she might have said?
It matters a lot that we don't know who this person is. It was such an extraordinary thing for the New York Times. And again, we're talking about the editorial page operation here, which is totally separate from the newsroom, for them to grant anonymity to someone for something like this. And my hunch is that we're going to find out who this person was. And, you know, when you say senior administration official, for the New York Times, is the sake of their own credibility, it better be a pretty high-ranking official, because the sort of bill of particulars that essentially the, you know, president is unhinged and that within his own administration there is a resistance movement has basically, you know, sort of stopped this entire city of Washington in its tracks.
I want to hear – we have a little clip from a senior administration official, a named one. That would be Vice President Mike Pence. His office has denied officially that he was the person who authored the anonymous Times piece. Pence told WFTV in Orlando on Thursday that the administration official who wrote it should step down.
Anyone who would write an anonymous editorial smearing this president, who's provided extraordinary leadership to this country, should not be working for this administration. They ought to do the honorable thing and they ought to resign.
Perry Bacon, how do you make sense of what you read in that piece? Is it consistent with what we know? Does it tell us something new?
I think it is consistent with what we already knew. To some extent, the Michael Wolff book, a lot of the reporting done in the Washington Post, in the New York Times, the Bob Woodward book that's coming out next week, there's a lot of reporting that people on Trump's staff don't trust his decision-making and try to work around him, make sure he doesn't see memos, try to backtrack and stop him from doing things, or try to reverse what he already does. Remember, General Mattis, or Secretary Mattis, was really opposed to the transgender ban in the military that Trump has kind of imposed now, but with Mattis trying to stop it, essentially. So we have a lot of evidence that the staff does not trust him. So in some ways, I thought it was important this ran this week because, you know, the Woodward book came out and then all these people went on the record like Mattis, like General Kelly, and said, no, I cannot believe these things that he said about me are true. So this op-ed, to some extent, made me reinforce what Woodward wrote this week, which is that probably there are people on Trump's staff, like Gary Cohn when he was there, who don't trust his judgment. I think, and that's why I thought the piece was worth publishing, because to some extent, we know that Trump's staff has some doubts about him. And we don't know who wrote this. Like Karen said, it could be the deputy secretary. It could be, you know, Pence's speechwriter. Could be Pence himself. We don't know. I don't buy these denials are meaningless, so I don't really take much account of them. The fact that people are saying I didn't write this op-ed, of course they're not going to admit they wrote the op-ed, but I think it was a meaningful and important piece that came out.
Well, just to be clear, you said it could be the deputy treasury secretary. If the deputy, or it could be the deputy transportation secretary, because we don't know. If it's, let's say it's the deputy transportation secretary, not to denigrate whomever that may be. I can't tell you offhand.
I can't either.
Does that actually end up adding to our understanding, or is that somebody from, you know, a relatively minor slot but a relatively senior sounding title taking pot shots at the president?
I would say if a person in a cabinet role or a deputy to cabinet agency, and maybe transportation is a bad one, if it's the deputy treasury secretary, maybe if that person is saying, not only do I oppose the president, but the staff and the team work constantly to work around him and resist his goals, I think that is important, if only because we didn't elect any of these people. We only elected Donald Trump. So it makes me a little uncomfortable on some level that this person feels the need to write and say we have kind of a shadow government because our actual president we don't trust. That's an important thing to think about.
Well, so Jack Beatty, let's talk about the op-ed in historical context. Again, the White House official who wrote this, described as a senior official, was not named. We don't know who he or she is. The Times, in a tweet, I think, described the writer as a he and then said that was a mistake, didn't mean to indicate one gender or the other. You know, if you've got essentially an understanding among a tight circle of senior officials that they will curb the president, thwart the president, remove information from him that might allow him or enable him to do policies they disagree with. You know, have we seen anything quite like this before?
Well, on just the issue of presidential incapacity, which is apart from the thwarting of the presidential will, we do have a precedent, and that is Woodrow Wilson. In the fall of 1919, he, campaigning for the League of Nations, he had a stroke, severely impaired. And he was in office because of the constitutional limit until March 1921. Long time. Who ruled? Well, he was fitfully able to participate, but basically his physician, Carrie Grayson, and his wife, Edith, ran the country as a kind of, regent for the president. Wilson retained his faculties when Senator Lodge bared at him and said, we're praying for you, Mr. President.
But nonetheless, they're stepped in to basically say, we think the country needs a little bit of supervision, in a sense, from somebody who can handle it. I do want to go. We've got a call from Cleveland, Ohio. Richard is on the air. Richard, what's on your mind?
Hello, David.
Hiya.
I think what we're dealing with is the Mad King syndrome. And England had a few Mad Kings. France had a few Mad Kings. And what we're dealing with someone who does not have, who has shown that they do not have the background or capacity to do this job properly. And they are a narcissistic, childlike person.
Uh-huh.
I applaud the book, and we'll pick it up, and I applaud with banging on the drums for the person who wrote the article.
Richard, thanks so much. Richard, thank you so much for your call, talking about Bob Woodward's book, Fear, of course, that's making the point. I just want to say one thing.
David, could I just continue the point I was trying to make? I was trying to make the other point, too. That's one case. Another one would be Richard Nixon in the, quote, final days. And we know now that he was engaging in colloquies with portraits of John F. Kennedy. He was having drunken prayer sessions with Henry Kissinger. He was all but chewing the rug. And within his own government, people were opposing him. James Schlesinger, the Secretary of Defense, sent out a basically said to the military, if you get any orders from the president, clear them with me in advance. Henry Kissinger later said, I was keeping the world from falling apart, while Haig was keeping the domestic United States running because the president was all but incapacitated. But we didn't know at the time the degree of the presidential incapacity. We do now. And this official, high official, whoever he is, has essentially made a version of the bargain that Republicans have made in Congress. David Frum, the analyst, has said, if conservatives have to choose between democracy and conservatism, they will choose conservatism. In effect, this person is doing that. He's saying, the president seems to be a threat to democracy, but he's good on policy, so I'm going to soldier on, and we are going to soldier on.
And it's interesting, if you think about the book by Bob Woodward and Karen Tumulty, I want you to weigh in on this in a moment, that he says, you know, John Kelly, the chief of staff, called the White House crazy town, that Secretary of Defense James Mattis questioned the intelligence of the president. We've got about 45 seconds left before the end of this segment for you, Karen. But tell me whether or not, you know, this is a sustainable environment for these figures to operate.
I think that it especially the op-ed, I mean, Bob Woodward's book has names attached and specifics. This op-ed writer, all they did was sort of aggrandize themselves and probably make the environment for these so-called unsung heroes this much more difficult, because this person would have known that they were setting off, to use Trump's own phrase, a witch hunt within this White House that is going to make life a, you know, living hell for the people that he was praising in this op-ed.
From crazy town to a living hell, strong words but turbulent times. We're talking about the week's top stories. You can join the conversation. How do you judge Brett Kavanaugh? Democrats aren't treating this as a normal hearing. Are they being principled or just simply partisan? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hey, Tamara.
Hey, Domenico. All week long, Brett Kavanaugh will face his Senate confirmation hearings.
Yeah, he's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, and there are going to be a lot of questions about how he could transform the Supreme Court for a generation.
The NPR Politics podcast will be following those hearings, and we'll hop in the studio every day to break down what you need to know.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're looking at the week in the news. You can join our conversation. Are the senators in the Kavanaugh hearings raising the right questions? What do you think of his answers? Another progressive victory in a Democratic primary. Where do you think these midterms are headed? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Perry Bacon Jr. of 538, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, somebody who's thinking a lot about these midterm elections would include our own president, President Trump. During a Thursday night campaign rally in Billings, Montana, Trump told his supporters that if they didn't turn out to vote in November, his political enemies would come after him.
They'll say, we want to impeach him, and you'll impeach him. It's so ridiculous. But worry about that if it ever happens. But if it does happen, it's your fault because you didn't go out to vote. Okay? You didn't go out to vote. You didn't go out to vote. That's the only way it could happen. I'll be the only president in history. They'll say, what a job he's done. By the way, we're impeaching him.
President Trump apparently also will not answer federal investigators' questions in writing or in person about whether he tried to block the probe into Russian interference in the 2016 election. That is what Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, told the Associated Press Friday morning, this morning. He said questions about obstruction of justice were a no-go. It seems as though these two things in some ways tethered together closely in the president's mind, the midterm elections and his own fate. So let's, before we get to the hearings, which I want to spend some time on this morning, I want to touch on the midterm elections a little bit. Perry Bacon Jr., tell me a little bit about where things look to you as to where they're going. Is there going to be a blue surge, or is the picture a little bit more clouded?
You know, our analysis at 5:30 has been that the Democrats are favored to win the House pretty substantially. The Senate is probably favored to be controlled by the Republicans still. And I think Trump is getting into something important there when in 2006 and 2010, what we saw in the data was that the president's party in 2014, too, so it's 06, 2010, 2014, the midterms, the president's party was not motivated, but the opposition party was. But the data right now is showing that Democrats are very, very, you know, they're going to run to the polls, not walk there. But at the same time, you've seen that Republican enthusiasm is pretty high. And I think part of that is Trump is saying, if you support me, this is an election about defending me from impeachment, which actually Trump and the Republicans bring up impeachment much more. Like Nancy Pelosi never talks about impeachment, you know, but the Democrats, but the Republicans are. And I think Trump has a good message, which is for his base, which is like, you, if you don't vote, I'm in trouble. Help me, defend me. And he's making the midterms very personal, which I think is smart for his base, at least.
You know, in Boston, Boston City Councilwoman Ayanna Pressley upset a multi-term congressman who had held John F. Kennedy's old seat in Congress. She's a progressive with roots there. Jack Beatty, you wrote a biography of one Boston mayor, and I think you co-wrote a memoir with another. What is the significance of Pressley's upset win?
Well, in Boston political history, it echoes something that happened in the late 19th century and early 20th century. The Irish Americans had been voting for Yankee Democrats as congressmen, as mayors, that is to say, Protestant Democrats. And starting early in the 20th century, they changed from voting for people by the name of Quincy and Frothingham and names like that to names like Fitzgerald and Curley. And really, they wanted to vote for people who looked like them and whose experience reflected their life experience. So now, Boston is a majority-minority city, and Boston's minorities said here, we want someone who, not in views, because she has the same views as Mr. Capuano, but in life experience has walked in our shoes. We want a congressperson who looks like us, just was as the Irish said at the turn of the century. And I think it indicates a big turn of Boston politics in the future. Mm-hmm.
Here's Ayanna Pressley. She's addressing her supporters in Boston earlier this week after she won the Democratic nomination for her Massachusetts congressional district.
To our immigrants worried about the knock on the door, change can't wait. To women whose rights are perpetually under attack, change can't wait.
That's Ayanna Pressley. She's now presumed to be will be the winner in November after she won the Democratic nomination over long-term Congressman Michael Capuano. I want to turn now to events that are happening in Washington this week. We're thinking, of course, about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. The hearings kicked off this week in Washington, the Senate Judiciary Committee. On Wednesday, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein, she raised questions echoed by Ayanna Pressley. She asked Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh about a woman's right to an abortion. Here's what Judge Kavanaugh had to say in response.
As a judge, it is an important precedent of the Supreme Court. By it, I mean Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Been reaffirmed many times. Casey is precedent on precedent, which itself is an important factor to remember. And I understand the significance of the issue.
Karen Tumulty, you know, that is the kind of exchange you'd almost expect in any hearing of a Supreme Court nominee. That is one of the litmus test issues for both sides of the aisle. But this was not particularly normal confirmation hearings. This was remarkable. What did you see unfold in front of you this week?
Well, a lot of civil disobedience during the proceedings. I think the protesters were interrupting it for at some points, you know, just every few minutes. What is at issue here is this is not just any Supreme Court justice here. He is replacing Justice Kennedy, the swing vote on the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has the power to overturn settled law. And so while Brett Kavanaugh is giving a lot of assurances that that is how he views Roe v. Wade, and of course that being the sort of front and center among issues on this, you also see the Democrats producing old documents from his time as an associate counsel at the Bush White House, where he was actually raising questions about referring to it as settled law. But this is really turning out to be only one part of these hearings. His confirmation is almost certainly going to go through, but there are a lot of issues being raised, many of which have to do with his definition of executive power, given that he would be going onto the court at a time when we have a president who has a very expansive view of his own power.
I'd like to take a call from Arlington, Virginia. Joe, you're calling. What struck you about these hearings? What struck you as noteworthy about them?
Hi, David. When I see the clip of Senator Booker.
It's Cory Booker of New Jersey, yeah?
Correct. Him being told not to release the documents by Senator Cornyn and Senator Grassley. When I read the document, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with national security. So I wonder if there is a legit reason that they're not releasing these documents to the public. Because I think Justice Brandeis said that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Uh-huh. So it would be nice if the American public could see all of the documents that the archives and the administration's holding. Thank you.
Actually, thanks so much for your call, Joe. Karen Tumulty, go ahead.
Yeah, it turned out that the documents to which Cory Booker was referring in his what he called his "I Am Spartacus" moment had actually been released. It was a little turned out to be a lot more drama to that moment. They had in fact already been cleared for release. But the larger point is that there are there's a lot of stuff here that either has been deemed Senate eyes only or that they haven't seen at all.
Perry Bacon, the caller's alluding to the question of whether or not all kinds of documents were withheld. There's different percentages being said about how much is being held back, 94%, 92%, whatever it is of documents. And it's being vetted by, as has been said, a lawyer with ties to Kavanaugh as well as the Bush, George W. Bush administration in which he served. How much of this is a fight over that fifth conservative vote on the bench? How much of it is a fight over whether he'd be reviewing President Trump's own, the legal challenges to him potentially by a special prosecutor? And how much of this is payback for the fact that Republicans were unwilling to even give a hearing to Merrick Garland when he was nominated by President Obama in his final year?
I think you've raised the right three issues. The first is, I think, the Democrats view the Garland treatment, the non-hearing, as kind of an original sin. We've been having Supreme Court fights for a long time, going back to Marshall or Bork. But I think the Democrats view not giving Garland a hearing to be a norm violation, a violation of sort of the how the Senate should work, that they do feel very angry. But I think that explains some of their ferocity this week. I do think the fifth seat is important. I mean, the idea being that it appears, from everything I've heard, that Kavanaugh is significantly more conservative than Justice Kennedy. So that means that on a whole host of issues, the court could move to the right. So I think the Democrats are really talking about policy a lot because that is a huge impact here. And the third thing is that Kavanaugh is a pretty traditional Republican, I would say, person. He served in the Bush administration. He could be a Republican senator in a lot of ways, and I think he would fit in pretty well there in terms of his political views or his philosophy. But we're in unusual times, and the senators kept basically asking, how does your view of presidential power fit into a Donald Trump presidency. The question they were trying to get at was, you know, you seem to think that maybe special counsels maybe should or shouldn't exist. You're not sure if the Department of Justice should investigate the president. So how would that work if we're having a Mueller probe? Donald Trump is maybe, you know, is being investigated. Some kind of case comes to you about should President Trump be investigated? How should that work? How should the Mueller probe work? The Democrats are raising, I think, reasonable questions about, you know, how does Kavanaugh's views, I think Kavanaugh's views would matter less if Marco Rubio was president about presidential power, but Donald Trump is president, and that makes it a big shift, and his views about the presidency are, I would argue, are unusual, Donald Trump's, and therefore what Kavanaugh does in those decisions is very important here.
You know, it was striking. There was this remarkable exchange between the California Democratic Senator Kamala Harris and Judge Kavanaugh, where she asked him if he had spoken about the Mueller probe with anyone, with anything to do with the law firm of one of President Trump's longtime lawyers, Mark Kasowitz. And there was this back and forth where Kavanaugh seemed almost unaware of the law firm or the idea that he could have spoken with the lawyer. And he said, I need you to specify. And she said, have you done it? And he didn't do anything. This morning, the Washington Post's Carol Lenning, I guess, among others, reports that that Judge Kavanaugh acknowledges that he's actually close friends with a partner at Kasowitz's firm, but that he says he's never talked about the Mueller probe with that friend. Jack Beatty, how concerning is it, or how much should a judge have to disqualify himself from considering legal challenges to a president who nominates him to the highest bench in the land?
Well, Mr. Kavanaugh, Judge Kavanaugh, replied to that by saying, if I commit to recuse myself here, I'm breaching judicial independence. In effect, I'd be making a commitment to get your vote, Senator. And that is something that is against the whole grammar of judicial presentations for confirmation. So I can't do that. Breaches judicial independence. But this whole question of judicial independence, as Karen said, is really the heart of all this. And when you look at the Democrats brought this out, when you look at the sequence of how Federalist Society members were, the names were given to President Trump. In the campaign, there were two times where he had lists come out, and we didn't hear, and Brett Kavanaugh wasn't on those lists. He only got on the list, the short list, after Mueller was appointed, after the inquest began. And of all the people on the list, he has the most expansive views of presidential power. Presidents can't be harassed by criminal inquiries, for example. So is it, the Democrats kept saying, is this just a coincidence, or is it in effect the fix in? Has Trump Trump understand that if it comes to that, issues of subpoena or whatever it might be, Kavanaugh will vote with me.
Sure. You alluded to the Federalist Society, of course, a group that has essentially explicitly pushed to ensure conservative appointees to the federal bench and to the highest court. There's a call for us from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Harrison, tell us your thoughts today.
Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Just a couple of points I want to make. I mean, I'm not that old. I'm only 35 years old, so I haven't seen a lot of these. And plus, I had to go to work, so I couldn't really see everything. Before, I did get a chance to see Senator Booker make the comments about releasing classified documents. Now,
right.
I'm in the military, and, you know, I follow chain of command. It was appalling to me to see how, like, he could take the law into his own hands and say, well, I don't think these documents should be classified, so I'm just going to release them, even though his chain of command told him that they are classified. I thought that was kind of, like, weird. And then it just seems like throughout the hearing, it seems like they're asking the judge a lot of questions about, well, what if Trump does this? Would you do this? And it seems like it's more about the president instead of the judge. I haven't seen a lot of them. I mean, is this normal?
No. I think you're hitting on a real point there. Thanks, Harrison, for that, Carl. Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, how has the judge acquitted himself given the kinds of questions he's faced and the kinds of challenges that are being put to him from the Democratic side of the aisle?
Well, he's obviously well prepared for this. He knew what to expect. He has been putting a lot of emphasis on his personal story as a dad, and we've heard a lot about being a basketball coach. One moment that was sort of interesting, though, was when he was asked about the kind of attacks that the president has made on the intellect and the character of other members of the Supreme Court. And he just wouldn't go there. And that may have been a lesson he learned from Neil Gorsuch, who was critical of the president during the confirmation process on this issue, on the president's comments about specific members of the Supreme Court. And afterward, we heard reports that the president was ready to sort of, you know, rescind his nomination because he expects his justices to be loyal to him. So, you know, Brett Kavanaugh has a very thin line that he is
trying to walk a very fine line there, it sounds like. You know, interestingly, he also his supporters invoked the Ginsburg rule from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, saying, well, she wouldn't talk about abortion, so he can avoid certain issues as well. I watched a documentary on her this week on CNN in which it was clear she was pretty straightforward about how she felt about issues like abortion. Interesting in ways the precedents are cited that may not actually hold up quite under the scrutiny of light. We're discussing another lively week in the news. I want each of you, my guests, to hold. I hope listeners out there stay with us. We want you to join our conversation. What's moving you this week? Big tech appeared on Capitol Hill. There's Nike's big splash with Colin Kaepernick. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This message comes from On Point sponsor, Union of Concerned Scientists, creators of Got Science, a biweekly podcast where scientists break down why science matters to all of us. Got Science explores innovations in clean technology and climate solutions, the challenges of missile defense, and how science is critical to strengthening our democracy. Tune in on your favorite podcast app or at gotsciencepodcast.org.
As soon as you wake up, you need the latest. That's why Up First is here. It's NPR's morning news podcast. In just 10 minutes or so, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. The White House Chief of Staff John Kelly reportedly called the White House crazy town. He has now denied it. Our listener Scott Nicholson on Facebook says, I would say it's been the week from hell politics-wise, but then it seems like it's that every week nowadays. There's a lot of other news happening in the world, however. Let's take a look in the world of sport. Nike released its first ad in its new marketing campaign for the 30th anniversary of its first Just Do It commercials. One of the new ones features NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick.
Believe in something, even if it means sacrificing everything.
You can join the conversation. What's moving the world this week? What's moving your world? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and Perry Bacon Jr. of 538. Perry, you cover politics for 538, but it is a sport that focuses a lot, a site that focuses a lot on sports. What do you make of Nike taking a knee with Kaepernick, in a sense, standing behind this quarterback exiled from the NFL, even as Nike and the NFL are partners in such a big way commercially?
Without having the numbers in front of me, I suspect that Nike's customers are much different than, say, the NFL's customers in a city, let's say, like Jacksonville. And what I mean by that is the audience Nike's appealing to compared to, like, the American electorate, let's say, is probably younger Nike's audience, probably more non-white than the American electorate, and probably more people who live abroad, obviously, so more international. Nike's an international brand. The American electorate is obviously people who live in the United States. So I think the political incentives, if you look at how the NBA has handled Donald Trump, where LeBron James and Steph Curry are very aggressively against Trump versus the NFL is much more cautious about that. I think it goes to who the customers are. I don't think that Nike's taking a big risk. Nike's a large corporation. My guess is they feel like being in line with Kaepernick is probably good or neutral, at least in terms of their fan base. The NBA, if you look at their demographics, their fans are more liberal leaning. And so being anti-Trump Trump is not a big risk to LeBron James. He's a black athlete who's young, who lives in California now. I mean, that's not a big risk to him. Versus the NFL has a more politically diverse and more conservative fan base. And I think that's what's going on here. This Kaepernick story is entirely political, and it's really the politics of large corporations and how they're trying to figure out how to lead their fan base, but also like not irritate their fan base.
And it's interesting because you have the NFL with fairly, you know, wrestling with fairly restrictive rules. The NBA essentially affirming the right of their players to express themselves. Not everybody is comfortable with that. We have a call from Tampa, Florida. Mary Jo, you're on the air. How do you feel about this?
Hi, David. I feel that these demonstrations are really out of place because it's not our nation that in a whole has a problem with inappropriate shootings of civilians, which I find really sad. I believe that the platform that they're using is inappropriate to insult the national anthem is inappropriate because of cities and states that these incidences are happening in. Therefore, I believe that if the players really want to affect change and not draw attention to themselves and their failing careers in the NFL, they should go to the governors and the mayors of the states where these shootings are occurring and really stand on those steps and say, enough is enough. Let's do some more protective and proactive policing in our communities so we don't lose any more lives. Why should we insult our nation and our national anthem when it's not our nation that's promoting this kind of behavior?
So, Mary Jo, you see it as an insult because of the way where it occurs and how it occurs, that is, during the national anthem as flags are waving. Of course, thank you so much for that, Mary Jo. The president offers some support for that. On Wednesday, he tweeted, just like the NFL, whose ratings have gone way down, Nike is getting absolutely killed with anger and boycotts. I wonder if they had any idea it would be this way. And there was a dip in Nike's share price, according to several news reports after that announced. Of course, these things tend to bounce back. Trump further tweeted, as far as the NFL is concerned, I just find it hard to watch and always will until they stand for the flag, at least in the first game on Thursday evening. I think players tended not to take a knee during that. Obviously, they say that not protesting the flag at all. They're protesting police shootings of African Americans. Trump on Twitter this morning, simply, what was Nike thinking? Karen Tumulty, what do you make of this? People sometimes want leadership from the president. Is he leading a public sentiment on this issue?
He is certainly leading sentiment in his base and, in fact, has essentially created this practically as an issue within his base. But it is part of what the flag represents. People have died throughout our history in wars is to fight for the right of people to express themselves in this country, in this society, as they choose to do. So, in many ways, and as we see on so many other fronts, this is, setting up a clash of what you really believe American values are here.
Mm-hmm. It is an interesting moment. There is, however, also support for what Kaepernick is up to and what Nike is up to. I believe we have a call from Fort Ann, New York. John, you're on the air. What are your thoughts on this? John, you there, fella?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for joining us today. What's your thoughts on this?
We're talking about Colin Kaepernick.
Yes, sir.
Yes. My point was that I'm supportive of him, and the reason why is indirect. When I was younger, when I was a kid, they used to show the national anthem on TV. Now they choose to break for commercial. So how can corporate America or the NFL say Kaepernick did such a terrible thing when they chose to show a commercial instead of the national anthem?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that, John. You know, it's just another way in which it seems to me that you see politics intersecting with areas in life that would seem initially to be outside of politics. There's another moment that we saw this week in Washington in which lawmakers were starting to take a look at digital media, social media, the giants. Among those testifying on Capitol Hill was Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg. She told lawmakers that the company is getting better at finding and combating adversaries who try to use the social media platform.
We are more determined than our opponents, and we will keep fighting. When bad actors try to use our site, we will block them. When content violates our policies, we will take it down.
And it was interesting because you had this week lawmakers essentially lauding Twitter and Facebook for taking incredible strides to combat the dissemination of intentionally false information and particularly acts by foreign powers to try to interfere with our midterms in the way that we saw with Russia in the 2016 election. That was a strong contrast to what happened in the spring. There's another issue that I think we should also talk a bit about this morning. The Attorney General of the State of New York, I'm broadcasting today from New York City, as we generally do here on Fridays. The Attorney General for the State of New York demanded records from every diocese of the Catholic Church throughout the state as a result of what investigations have uncovered in other states. Karen Tumulty, you've written about your Catholic faith. You've also written about the issue of abuse within the church. What do you make of the latest developments?
I think that this shows that we're at the beginning of this scandal, not at the end with the revelations that came out of Pennsylvania. And from what I understand, there are probably at least a dozen other states and potentially the federal government trying to figure out how they look into this. One thing worth keeping in mind is that not every state attorney general has the same set of powers. Pennsylvania's attorney general has a lot of power to conduct an investigation through a grand jury, to write a report, even if he's not indicting people. In New York, the attorney general can do a lot on the civil side, but needs to partner with district attorneys on the criminal side. All these states are kind of trying to figure their own way through this. But a big question is going to be whether the Catholic Church itself steps up and provides the documentary evidence, the records that it has been keeping secret.
I'd like to take a call now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mike, you're on the air. You had something you wanted to share on this question.
Hi, David. When the movie The Da Vinci Code came out, I thought it was a very good book of fiction until the press conservative Catholic hierarchy made such a stink about it. I thought, well, maybe there is some truth to it. But the history of the Catholic Church, the last liberal pope was 1978, Pope John Paul I, who mysteriously died in his sleep 30 days after he was selected the pope. So I feel...
Certainly dramatic timing.
I think the Pope, the current Pope, is living in the small little hotel near the Vatican for his safety, because I don't think the conservatives, I think the evil within the Vatican is so unfathomable that this could actually be life-threatening for the Pope if he speaks up against this, because I think the conservatives are literally that diabolical.
Well. Thank you, Mike, for that. Certainly, I guess Mike is reflecting his concern that this is a matter of church intrigue. There does seem to be tensions between, obviously, a liberalizing pope and his conservative critics, and there's been, in a sense, an inversion, Jack Beattie, of some of the dynamics we've seen in the church, where it seemed as those liberal critics were criticizing a conservative leadership of the church for not acting strongly enough on abuse. Jack Beattie, you know, Karen Tumulty says this is in some ways the beginning, and it does feel like that if there are so many more jurisdictions in which this can be looked at the same times. If you think about the issues raised in Boston, by the Boston Globe in over 15 years ago, it's kind of incredible to think that we're at the start of this all over again.
Yes, and I think it testifies to the residual power of the church, power over legislators to keep this scandal from blowing up. You know, what we're seeing is an institution losing its moral authority. In Ireland, when there was a referendum on abortion that passed overwhelmingly, a poll found that only 1% of Catholics took their views on abortion, on how to vote, from the church. In effect, as one expert said, a Protestant Reformation has been happening within Irish Catholics, and I think is starting to happen here, where instead of, you know, having the priest be the person who tells you, speaks to you in matters of faith and morals, that just as in Protestantism, Catholics are making up their own minds, and the hierarchy doesn't figure. Does that mean it's only a question of time before the priesthood disappears or changes radically? We don't know, but we're on the trail that leads to, or that could lead to, something like Shakespeare's bare ruined choirs in the future.
I want to give each of you a chance. You know, we've raised so many issues here that some things don't get on the radar, but might be on your radar. Perry Bacon, what stories do you think haven't gotten the attention you deserve this week that you've been trying to follow as well?
We've kind of hit on these things a little bit, but I think there's a connective tissue. You saw earlier in the week, there was a controversy about Steve Bannon being invited, the former Trump aide being invited to the New Yorker Festival. Mm-hmm. A lot of the, and then he being disinvited. You saw this week the hearing on Capitol about Twitter and Facebook turned into a little bit of, is Twitter mean to conservatives? And you also had the Kaepernick thing. And I think you have in all these instances where institutions and businesses that used to be trying to be apolitical are finding themselves in the middle of these kind of partisan wars. And I think they're struggling with two different questions, one of which is the priority to be fair and equal to both sides, which is what the conservatives basically say, or is the priority to have certain values, particularly to value what I would call anti-racism, which is what kind of a liberal say. So the liberals say Kaepernick, good, Bannon, bad, Alex Jones, bad, and the conservatives say to some extent Bannon and conservatives should have the ability to speak in public if Kaepernick does too. And so I think you're seeing these wars where these institutions like, you know, news outlets, businesses and so on really have to figure out what are our values and how do we stay maybe political but not partisan when everything right now is partisan in one of two sides.
Political but not partisan. Karen Tumulty, how about you?
Well, a story that in a normal week would have been a huge story was Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's very surprising decision not to run for another term as mayor. It is a reflection of the challenges that are facing Chicago in particular, but a lot of big city mayors because, you know, it's both the violence in the city, the fiscal problems in the city. These are big issues that are playing out close to home for a lot of people. And we get so wrapped up in things here in Washington that I think we don't pay as much attention to them as we should.
And Jack Beatty, bring us home. We've got about 45 seconds. Tell us what's been on your radar and that doesn't necessarily burst through in a week where you've got Crazy Town and Woodward's book and the anonymous White House official.
Well, it was really Rahm Emanuel, but a case of that, an instance, is in San Francisco, where there was a big story about the mayor starting a campaign to try to, you know, clean the streets that are being fouled by homeless people because there are so many of them. And that just brings out what people have been saying about Chicago. It's true of San Francisco. It's true of Boston. We have a tale of two cities in America. Cities have never been more prosperous. Boston looks like Manhattan now, parts of it. At the same time, we have this desperate, rooted, chronic poverty in the cities and in its worst instance in homelessness. And the tale of two cities, can the two cities coexist?
Can the two cities coexist? Well, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, thank you for bringing us home today.
Thank you.
Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, covers national politics, joined us as well. So glad to have you with us.
My pleasure.
And we also heard from Perry Bacon Jr., senior political writer for 538. Thanks so much, Perry, for being here.
Thanks, David. Enjoyed it.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Kyrie Thompson, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Madeline D'Angelo and Lexi Puri. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this This is On Point.